The Middle Ages, the third talk in a series on church history, was presented by Peter Waringa on September 20, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
This morning we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about church history. This last spring I had two sessions that we talked about church history. We're going to talk about church history this week. We're going to talk about church history next week. And then Earl Craig will be here the week after that, and then we're going to be talking about church history again for 1 week after Earl is here. So for a couple weeks, we're going to spend some time talking about church history. And the challenge before me this morning is to try to figure out how to condense 1,000 years of church history into 45 minutes, or if I go by that clock, which is stopped, I can go indefinitely. But I've been warned already by, I think, 15 or 20 people that clock isn't working, so I shouldn't pay attention to it. But we're going to try to figure out how to, I better take my watch off so I can keep track. We're going to try to condense 1,000 years of church history into 45 minutes or so, and then try to leave some time for questions. This should be interesting. And what I wanted to do, just to kind of pick up on some of the things that I said this last spring when we were talking about church history, is a study of the history of the church is, it's a fascinating thing, because the church as it has come to take shape over the years is, I'm sure, in many respects very different from what was envisioned when Jesus and when the authors of the New Testament talked about the church and talked about what it was all about. Now, the church over the years has taken a number of different institutional forms, and let me make it clear, there is nothing wrong in and of itself. There's nothing wrong with an institution. There's nothing wrong with getting things organized. But something becomes terribly wrong when we end up clinging to institutions for the sake of the institution, or when we end up trying to protect something for the sake of protecting it. I'm sure we've all had experiences of churches that have ended up in an all-out battle over church property, over a building, over who was going to control a building. Years ago, there were denominations, whole denominations, that were wrestling with this issue. There are churches that end up in all-out warfare over the type of songs that they'll be singing. Are they going to be singing traditional songs? Are they going to be singing more contemporary songs? Well, those are not the things that are worth doing battle over within the church. So we need to find there some balance, because there is nothing wrong with, as I said, getting things organized. We are, as human beings, we are culture makers, and so we try to shape things and we try to form things so that they're useful. But when we get to the point that usefulness has been outlived, and when we try to cling to things simply because that's the way we've always done it, then we run into problems. Well, that's all by way of background to let you know that the church, we're going to be talking about the church in the Middle Ages, the church from roughly around the early 4th century up until around 1300 or so. And the church in the Middle Ages was pretty doggone messy. I mean, things got very confused relatively quickly in the church in the Middle Ages. It's sometimes easy for people to think that that when we look at tradition, when we look at the way the church has been, there are some church traditions even today that will stand on the fact that their church has been around for 2,000 years. Their church goes all the way back to the apostles. Well, the problem with that view is that for many of those years, it pretty much doesn't matter what church tradition you adhere to. There's been just a whole lot of confusion and a whole lot of messiness. And sometimes people think, well, things really got settled for the church in 325 AD with the Council of Nicaea. Sometimes people think that's when things got sorted out and got settled. Well, in my mind, in many respects, that marks the time that the church began to get into more trouble. When Christianity was legalized in 312 AD, and this is what I talked about several months ago, Christianity was legalized under Constantine, and then later in the 4th century, Christianity was made the state religion. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination to figure out that problems would follow when Christianity was made the state religion. Imagine in our own situation, or imagine in any other country around the world, if and when, and it's happened at different times, if and when Christianity is made the state religion, look at the problems that result. Because as soon as that happens, one of the dynamics that comes into play is that the quest for influence, the influence of money, the quest for power, all of those sorts of things end up naturally becoming major factors in what goes on within the church. And that certainly was happening in the church in Europe. We're talking here about Western Europe, basically, is what we're going to be focusing on. That certainly was the case with the church in Western Europe in the 4th century. Problems were not solved, issues were not solved with the Council of Nicaea, when just prior to that Christianity was legalized at the Council of Nicaea, when an awful lot of the doctrinal questions began to be settled. The problem was that the doctrinal questions weren't settled. The major doctrinal questions that were addressed at the Council were still under discussion and debate, and there was still a lot of going back and forth, actively going back and forth for 50 years after that time, and indeed for about 700 years, it was about 700 years after that time, there was a growing division between the church in the East and the church in the West. Now, we're going to end up focusing on the church in the West, but let me just give you a brief history about what happened with regard to the church in the East. The church in the East, when we talk about Orthodox churches today, those are the churches that have their heritage in the church in the East. Well, the church in the West and the church in the East began to split more obviously as a result of the discussions at the Council of Nicaea. And an awful lot of those discussions centered around the whole question about who is Jesus, what's the Trinity all about, all that sort of thing. And what became a huge issue, and this is critically important, I want you all to understand this, pardon my tongue in cheek, what became critical for them was the question of whether or not the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father alone, or whether the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father and the Son. You see, that was the main doctrinal issue that eventually ended up splitting the church. There was one word that was added to the Nicene Creed, the Latin word filioque, that was added to the Nicene Creed, where the church in the West said the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, and the church in the East would have none of that, because they knew that the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father through the Son. So this became a major cause of issue division between the two churches. This is now 1,000 years, or 700 years in 2 minutes here, till it got to the point in 1054, the final split between the church in the East and the church in the West was when, in 1054, the church in the East, Pope Leo sent an emissary, Cardinal Umberto, I think was his name, sent him as an emissary to the church in the East, to Constantinople, where the cardinal interrupted the church service, interrupted the communion service that was going on in the Sancta Sophia Church in Constantinople, interrupted that church long enough to excommunicate the patriarch of the church in the East, which was basically the Pope of the church in the East, excommunicated the patriarch, as well as everyone who followed the teaching of the patriarch, excommunicated all of them, and then got out of town. Well, the problem was, I mean, I'm not sure exactly how this works in the bigger eternal scheme of things, because Pope Leo, who had issued the excommunication, had actually died a few days before the cardinal got to Constantinople. If he had just done it by email, everything would have been clear, would have been done in a timely manner. But you can, I'm obviously being sarcastic here, but you get a little bit of a feel for what often is some of the silliness that we engage in the church. And in the church in the Middle Ages, there were, beginning with the Council of Nicaea, there were all sorts of issues that came up. Now, even as I say that, and we're gonna focus on that, those issues, because that is the bigger part of church history. But let me be very clear that throughout the history of the church, there has always been a faithful remnant that God has maintained throughout the history of the church as what I would suggest to you is the true church. Sometimes it lined up well with the visible and institutional church. Sometimes it found a home and a place in the institutional church. Sometimes it didn't. But I want to make it very clear that throughout the history of the church, God has always maintained people throughout all time who have remained faithful to who he is. Sometimes with more knowledge and more understanding than other times, but that's God's job. The way I look at it, that's God's job to maintain the faithfulness of the church, and he's certainly done that over the time. But the institution has often gotten things pretty confused. Well, I want to talk about several things with regard to the development of the history of the church in the West. There are several things that became major movements or major components of what the church in the West was all about. One of those has to do with the monastic movement. And those of us who have grown up in a Protestant tradition really aren't very familiar with the monastic movement. That's not something that we know a lot about, but the monastic movement has been very important in the history of the church in the West, particularly in the Middle Ages. And the monastic movement, let me try to kind of summarize a little bit about what I think is the impulse behind the monastic movement, and that is, we understand, as believers, we understand somewhat intuitively, we understand also from reading the scriptures, we understand that we as believers are an odd and a peculiar people. Sometimes the scriptures are explicit about that when they refer to us as aliens and strangers, when Peter makes that reference, for example. Sometimes it's not as explicit, but we understand that we don't exactly fit into the world. And Jesus talked about that at some length in John, in the section that we think of as the Upper Room Discourse. Jesus talked about our relationship to the world. And he specifically, in his prayer in John 17, he specifically says, God sent you into the world. He isn't trying to take you out of the world. He sent you into the world, but you are not to be of the world. And so that's been the difficulty. That's been the tension that we've always had as believers, is trying to figure out, okay, how is it that we are to be in the world? We are to be salt and light in the world. We're to have an effect in the world and have a role in the world. How is it that we're to be that and yet not be of the world, yet not embrace what the world is all about and the world system is all about? How do we do that? Well, that's a struggle, I would guess, for every one of us individually. That's a struggle for the church as well. And early in the history of the church, The way some people responded to that question was they decided, okay, the only way that I can be faithful is to, in fact, get out of the world. The only way I can not be of the world is to try to get out of the world with all of its temptations. And so you had in the in the 3rd and 4th century, you had the beginning of what are referred to as the desert saints, or the hermits is another way that they're referred to, individuals who believe that in order to live godly, faithful lives, they needed to go out into the desert to get away from everything and everyone in order to avoid temptation, in order to be able to simply contemplate who God is, in order to follow a truly spiritual life. There were some people who began that movement. Anthony was most notable amongst them in the early 4th century, early 5th century, rather. But what happened was, and I almost have to laugh when I read these things in church history, what happens is Anthony goes out into the desert to be alone. And word gets out about this unbelievably godly, pious man who is out in the desert. And so people go out into the desert to be with him. So he goes a little bit further out into the desert, and people keep following him. And what actually ended up happening, Anthony is trying to be alone. And what Anthony ended up finally doing was agreeing to be a part of a community of people as long as nobody bothered him too much. Well, that again, in a very simplistic way, that just gives you some idea of how the monastic movement began, and I think was much of the impulse behind the monastic movement, and that is to try to figure out how to be separate enough to be able to avoid some of the temptations, some of the trials of living in the world, how to be separate enough to be able to do that. Early in the history of the church, there was also what I refer to as the lunatic fringe of the monastic movement, and that is those individuals who really got carried away with the whole thing. And the one in particular that comes to mind was an individual who comes down to us historically by the name of Simeon Stylites, or Simon Stylites. He lived from 390 to 459 A.D., He personally tried a number of things in order to purge himself of temptation and in order to figure out how to not to be of the world. He tried a number of things. He tried fasting. He tried going out into the desert. He tried to do things physically. He bound himself with palm fronds, even to the point that they would cut into his flesh. He tried to figure out what he could do in order to affect that process of not being of the world. And let me just note in passing here, that's another thing that I believe is a huge factor in this impulse, and that is, I think we as human beings often think if we're really going to please God, if we're really going to live spiritual lives, if we're really going to not be of the world, we need to do something. It's up to us. We need to figure out the system. We need to figure out the procedure. We need to figure out the action. We need to figure out what to do in order to live truly spiritual lives. I think that's just a natural human impulse. And Simon exemplified that quite well as he tried all these different things to try to figure out how to please God. And eventually what he figured out is that if he lived on a platform on top of a pillar, that would solve it. And so he constructed a 12-foot-tall pillar with a platform on top of it that he could live on. Now, there are some folks, the way I look at it, there are some folks who could actually, like, jump high enough to get his attention. 12 feet isn't that high. So over the years, he had to keep making the pillar higher and higher and higher until after 37 years, he was living on top of a pillar 50 feet off the ground. And from there, people would come to him from all over Christendom. People would come to him to hear him preach and to have him give counsel to people. In fact, there was a time when the emperor and his wife came to hear what he had to say. So We have Simon Stylites becoming famous. In fact, after he passed away, there were two major churches, the church in Antioch, the church in Constantinople, who were arguing over who got his bones, who got his body, because it was believed that he was such a holy man that there would be some benefit that would accrue to the church by having his body there. Now, to us, all of that stuff sounds kind of crazy. But what I would suggest, and these are the extremes. Again, let me emphasize, these are the extremes. But what I would suggest is that there are impulses within us and impulses within the church that tend us to go in the same sorts of directions. Maybe not to that extreme. Maybe not to the extreme of building a pillar and living on top of it. But still thinking in terms of, what are the one, two, three things that I need to do in order to please God? So just this is just by way of some background about the monastic movement. What eventually evolved into in the Middle Ages was that the monastic movement took several different forms. There were several different monastic movements. Dominicans, Franciscans were some of the ones that we're most familiar with. Saint Benedict instituted the Benedictine rule, which laid out some of the ground rules for monastic living. And the monastic movement in the Middle Ages became extremely widespread, extremely powerful, so that by the Middle Ages, the monastics or the monasteries owned a huge amount of the land in Europe, were amongst the wealthiest institutions in Europe, and were unbelievably powerful. So the people who had gone into monasteries in order to get away from the world, in order to live chaste, celibate lives of poverty and of contemplation, ended up in many cases being the very individuals who were most in the middle of the politics of the time, the struggles within the church, problems with money and with greed. The monasteries were often right in the middle of those things. But the monastic movement really had a lot to do with shaping and forming the church in the Middle Ages. Well, another thing that played a major role in the shaping of the church, obviously, was the papacy. And I can't remember if we talked about this in the spring or not, so let me just give you a quick recap. The papacy that the church would maintain, the church in the Middle Ages and even the Catholic Church today would maintain, that the papacy goes all the way back to Peter. And what they would maintain is the biblical basis for the formation of the papacy was the passage in Matthew 16, verses 13 through 19, when Jesus is having this discussion with his disciples, who do the people say that I am? And people answer with different replies, and then he says to his disciples, who do you say that I am? And Peter responds to him in that passage by saying, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Peter's response to that, or Jesus' response to that, rather, is to say to Peter, and I'm going to paraphrase here, I hope none of you have your Bible open to check me, but he says to Peter, basically, and I say to you, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. Well, there was a little bit of a play on words there, because the name Peter, Petros in Greek, means stone, and so the church tradition is that was Jesus' way of saying that Peter is the one who is the foundation of the church. Tradition then has it that Peter ended up going off to Rome, where he was eventually martyred, but that prior to the time he was martyred, he was in fact, by tradition, he was the bishop of the church in Rome. So the papacy traditionally goes back to that account and that tradition that Peter, as the bishop of the church in Rome and as the foundation of the church, basically set in place the fact that the bishop of Rome was to be the leader of the church, was to be, in fact, the head of the church. Well, for several hundred years after Peter died, the church in Rome really was not even an important church in the West at that time, or in the East. The churches in Constantinople, the churches in Alexandria, the churches in Antioch for the first several hundred years. Not Constantinople wasn't until the 4th century, but even prior to that time, Jerusalem, Antioch, Alexandria, some of those churches were more important, and the leaders of those churches had more say and more influence than did the church in Rome. But the tradition of the papacy is that the authority goes back to Jesus' words to Peter and Matthew. Well, in reality, what it ended up happening was that when the Roman Empire, or Roman Emperor, moved to the east and basically set up a court in Constantinople, that left a huge vacuum, a huge void in the West. And the head of the church in Rome over the years, especially in the 4th century, 5th century, the head of the church in Rome, the Bishop of Rome, ended up filling that void, ended up taking the lead both in church matters and ecclesiastical matters, as well as in civil matters. We have accounts of Leo the Great would be one of the first really influential popes or bishops of Rome. Leo the Great was in Rome and was leading the church there from 440 to 461 A.D., and what happened with Leo the Great was when the barbarians, when Attila and the Huns came knocking on the door and came to once again invade the city, there was no civil structure in place to protect the city. And the emperor in the east was not going to send forces, was not going to send reinforcement, was not going to send any help at all. So it fell to Leo to be the one to try to work things out with Attila, to try and keep the barbarians away from the door. And in fact, that's what he did to some degree. So you see, in an instance like that, you see the Pope, and the Pope simply comes from the word Papa, which means father. That's where the name came from. The Pope, who was the leader of the church in Rome, simply filled a need in terms of a civic need in his community, and in so doing became much more influential in temporal matters as well as in spiritual matters. A little bit later, there was another pope, Pope Gregory, who was in office from 590 to 604 A.D., Pope Gregory was a tremendous organizer in Rome at the time. He helped to organize food distribution, rebuilding projects around the city. The city had fallen into decay and disrepair by that time. So this particular pope helped to organize things and helped to give some shape to the society and to the culture at the time. So what we see in those years is that the pope begins to be given and to accept and exercise more and more power and influence because there was no other civil power and influence in the West at that time that would match the authority of the Pope. Well, what that led to was a huge battle that in many ways shaped the nature of the church from around 600, 700, 800 A.D. right through the Middle Ages. And that huge battle came from the struggle between civil leaders who had increasing power and authority and the Pope, who had this spiritual authority but also had civil authority that had come to him over the years. So what happened is there were rulers who were kings in the West of smaller areas, smaller territories, who began to grow in power. This eventually caused them to come into conflict with the Pope. And what happened was there was a Frankish king who would have been over in Gaul, the area that is now known as France. There was a Frankish king by the name of Charles Martel. And I love the nicknames that are given to folks throughout history. It was Charles the Hammer Martel. Because Charles Martel, what he is known for throughout history is when Islam swept across northern Africa. Now, Islam began in 7th century? Pardon? 6th century. When Islam began, it very quickly began to sweep across the world. It swept across northern Africa. Islam as a military movement, as a movement of conquest, quite honestly, Islam went across the Straits of Gibraltar, absolutely routed the kings that were in Spain, basically took control of most of Spain, and was only stopped, Islam was only stopped by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours in 732 AD. So Charles the Hammer Martel was known as the man who stopped the advance of Islam. Well, what happened was Charles Martel was actually, he was not actually the, and if I said this, I misspoke, he was not actually the king of the Franks at this time. He was actually the major domo, the main manager, if you will, of the kingdom. His son Pepin was made king when they got the Pope to agree to ask the current king, who goes by the name of Childeric the Stupid. You can see that the winners are the ones who write history. But Pepin was actually made king. He was Charles Martel's son. He was actually made king when the Pope insisted that Childeric abdicate the throne. And then Pepin's son was the man that we are quite familiar with in history. His son was Charles the Great, Charles Magnus, Charlemagne. So Charlemagne became was the king of the Franks, and he came to power right around 800. And there's this interesting story that's told about the coronation of Charlemagne. And the story is interesting because it really illustrates the struggle between the church and the state during this time. And the way the story was told to me when I was a freshman in college, and the way it was told is so great, I've got to repeat it as it was told. The way it was told to me is that Charlemagne was going to be crowned king of the Franks, and here the struggle, and you got to get into the fine points of understanding why this is a battle. The question was whether the Pope was going to be the one who crowned him or not. Because if the Pope crowned him, that would indicate clearly, symbolically to all, that it was the Pope who had authority over this king. And so the question was whether or not it was going to be the Pope who actually crowned Charlemagne or not. And the way the story was told to me was that when it came time for the coronation ceremony, the Pope at that time came up to Charlemagne and said, "Look, your shoe's untied." And then he put the throne on the king's head at that time. Now, that's the way the story was told to me, that the Pope actually, basically as a ruse, and there's actually some historical truth to this, the Pope crowned Charlemagne. Tradition has it then that Charlemagne removed the crown from his head because he was unwilling to be under the authority of the Pope, and then re-coronated himself. Well, the story is interesting primarily because it illustrates that the battle for control of Western civilization had begun between the church and the state. Who was going to be the final authority in Western Europe at this time? Was it going to be the church or was it going to be the state? And what happened, and there are just many, many parts to this that we're not going to get into, but what happened was it all came to a head late in the 11th century, so late in the 1000 AD period. It all came to a head with Emperor Henry IV and Pope Gregory, who were at loggerheads over this question about who had more authority. And to make a long story short here, what ended up happening was the two of them were in disagreement. One thing I should note here is that the Pope had a couple of tremendous tools at hand, available to him, in order to extend his civil authority. And those tools were this. The Pope, as the head of the church, had the right to be able to excommunicate any individual that he thought fell outside of the teaching of the church. And excommunication, as you can imagine, excommunication meant eternal damnation. So the Pope had that right over any individual, and even beyond that, the Pope had the right to put any country or any people or any group of people under interdict. And what that means, interdict simply means that at that point, that group of people, that country, could no longer participate in the sacraments. They could no longer participate in the Mass, be baptized, have the last rites given to them, that sort of thing. And that likewise meant, if in the teaching of the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, if you did not participate in the sacraments, that likewise meant that you would be damned for eternity. So you can see how those spiritual, quote-unquote, tools or weapons could be used civilly as well. And that's what happened in the case of Emperor Henry and Pope Gregory. They got in this argument about who had the final authority, and the Pope at that time had to be careful because Henry had tremendous political and military power. But what the Pope did was he excommunicated Henry, and he placed all of his lands under interdict. And all of a sudden, he had to stop what he was doing. He had to change gears. Well, the bottom line, as the story goes, was that eventually what ended up happening was Henry, the emperor, basically gave in to the claims of the Pope. The Pope found himself at a castle at Canossa, and as the story goes, the emperor ended up having to walk several days through the snow, sort of in repentance and in humiliation, in order to get to Canossa, where the Pope was holed up with his court, in order to get there and beg for the Pope's forgiveness and beg to have the excommunication and the interdict lifted. Well, the result of that, that sort of thing, as you can imagine, was known throughout Europe. That was not something that was done just in a vacuum. That was known throughout Europe. And the result of that is that at that point, the church was seen pretty much by everyone around Europe, was seen to be the most powerful, the most influential institution in Europe in the Middle Ages. So that's the point that it had gotten to by 1077 was the incident that we're talking about. Well, now I want to talk just a little bit about a period of time known as the High Middle Ages. The High Middle Ages were roughly from 1050 to 1300. You can't fix precise dates to these things, but I want to talk a little bit about the High Middle Ages, because the High Middle Ages were a time when the church was, in many respects, at its peak academically and educationally, at its peak in terms of its spiritual authority, its political power. The High Middle Ages were sort of the apex, if you will, of the power and authority and reach of the church in Europe and during this time. And in terms of the educational movement, in terms of academics, scholasticism was the movement within the church, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because scholasticism is a very complex school of thought, but scholasticism ended up being that movement within academia and that movement of learning that most shaped the church for the Middle Ages and beyond. Some of the names that you're probably familiar with regard to scholasticism are names like Anselm, Peter Abelard, Thomas Aquinas is probably the most well-known scholastic, Peter Lombard, Albert Magnus, Albertus Magnus. So you have individuals who were a part of the scholastic movement that grew and gained influence and ended up shaping the doctrine and the teaching of the Catholic Church. Really, from that point on, the Catholic Church to this day has been unbelievably influenced and shaped by the scholastic movement during this time. And in discussions that we've had here a couple of years ago, Jack was doing some teaching under the sermon titles. A series of sermons had to do with dealing with the question of whether or not Jesus had to die and what sense Jesus had to die, and he talked there about Anselm's teaching. Anselm, in his book Cur Deus Homo, Why the God-Man is the translation of that title, Anselm tried to make logical sense of why it was that Jesus had to die. And I would suggest that a problem with the scholastic movement, I would suggest, is that it often went beyond what the scriptures clearly taught and got into arguments that might very well be good and reasonable arguments, might very well make sense in a lot of ways, but indeed went beyond what the scriptures had to teach. And where that became a problem, where that's a problem to the present day, is that once anyone, whether it's the church in the Middle Ages or whether it's those of us who are here at Reformation Fellowship, once anyone goes to teaching beyond what the scriptures has to say and then hangs on to it and pounds their fist on the table with regard to that teaching and insists that that teaching is authoritative even beyond the authority of the scriptures, once that happens, the church is in trouble. And again, let me emphasize, it is not just the Catholic Church that does that. We in the Protestant Church are quick to do the same sort of thing. But there is a problem when one takes teaching and understanding beyond what the scriptures have to say and then insists that that teaching is as authoritative as is the teaching of the scriptures. And that's what happened to the church in the Middle Ages. The dogma of the church became every bit as authoritative as were the scriptures themselves, and that was a problem. That's what the Reformation eventually ended up dealing with. Well, let me just, I'm wrapping up here. Let me just talk a little bit about sort of the height of civil and political authority of the church during this time. Talked about what happened with the emperor and with the pope in 1077. But there was another emperor, Innocent III, 100 years later, who ended up being by far the most powerful pope in the history of the church, and was also, at the time, by far the most powerful individual in Europe at the time. Innocent was pope from 1198 to 1216. What's interesting is there are a couple of what became, they began as mendicant orders. That is, a mendicant order is a movement within the church that is, mendicant basically refers to sort of a beggar lifestyle. There were a couple of mendicant orders that began while Innocent was the pope, orders that were begun in order to begin to try to reform some of the abuses of the church, because, and I'll talk about this in just a minute as I conclude, there were widespread abuses within the church that were universally recognized. People everywhere recognized some of the problems in the church at this time. And so there were some groups of people who would form new movements, if you will. And I'm not saying form them in terms of consciously, okay, I'm going to start a movement and here's my business plan and here's what I'm going to do. There were individuals who would stand up rightly, speak out, take a stand for what was true, and some of those individuals ended up having people following them. Well, two of those movements appealed to the Pope for legitimacy, to Innocent III. One of them was St. Francis. The Franciscan movement began as a reform movement where Francis himself gave up all of his earthly possessions, preached against the abuses within the church, took a stand for what he believed was right and true. There was Francis, there was Dominic, who also did the same thing, and those individuals both ended up going to Pope Innocent and asking basically for his blessing, asking basically for his approval, submitting to the Pope their teaching, their practices, and asked for the Pope's approval. Both of those individuals, both of those movements, received his approval. But there were others who, and this is one of the oddities about church history, there were others who were very, very similar in many respects. In Gaul, there was Peter Waldo, there were the Waldensians, there were the Albigensians. There were others during this time who likewise were reform movements, who had that same impulse to reform the church, who would appeal to the Pope for his blessing and who did not receive it. In fact, when we think about the Spanish Inquisition, that's one of the things that we hear about in church history. When we think about the Spanish Inquisition, was formed in order to root out those heresies, those reform movement heresies that were spreading in Gaul and in Spain during the reign of Pope Innocent. He was the one who initiated the Spanish Inquisition. So Innocent had unbelievable power, unbelievable authority. I mean, quite honestly, I kind of get the impression he wasn't a bad guy. His authority went everywhere. In fact, all of the political rulers in Europe at that time were afraid of him, and they basically needed to shape their policies and to do what they were doing in light of what Innocent had in mind. In fact, we know of the tradition of King John in England signing the Magna Carta. Well, one of the reasons that his hand was forced, if you will, to sign the Magna Carta, to give up some of his authority, give it to the nobles that insisted that he sign it, one of the reasons was because Innocent had weakened John's authority in England. So Innocent had his hand in everything, in who ruled in which countries, what they did, where they went, in everything, both on the ecclesiastical or spiritual level as well as on the political or state level. Well, the impression that I have historically is that Innocent wasn't such a bad guy, but a guy came along almost 100 years later, Pope Boniface VIII, who really got confused about things. Pope Boniface VIII was the pope from 1294 to 1303, and it was under Pope Boniface VIII, and we'll see that this comes up again when we talk about the Reformation next week. Next week we're going to be jumping into the Reformation. Pope Boniface VIII was the one who first declared as a teaching of the church, as an authoritative teaching of the church, declared and affirmed two things. Number one, that it was necessary for every individual everywhere to be under the authority of the Pope in order to be saved. And if they were not under the authority of the Pope, they would not be saved. And indeed, he also instituted and formalized some of the sacramental system as a means to basically to convey that salvation. For members of the church in the Middle Ages, salvation then ended up being what happened when you were a part of the church and when you did certain things, i.e. participated in the sacramental system. When you were baptized as an infant, when you were married within the church, when you went to confession, when you participated in the Mass, the sacramental system ended up being the way by which, the means by which grace was conveyed to individuals. That was the way you were saved. And Boniface VIII was the one who made that a formal teaching of the church. It was in the papal bull Unam Sanctam that stated this dogma as a formal teaching of the church. And in so doing, it was his final attempt to extend to every corner of Europe at that time, to extend the authority of the church. Well, there were other problems that were going on in the church at that same time or soon after that, some problems that we'll talk about this next week. But basically, that was the beginning of a huge decline in both the authority, the credibility of the Pope. That was the beginning of a huge decline that was going to take place in the church in the next couple of hundred years. And let me just note in passing here as I'm wrapping up, I had mentioned earlier that that the church was, in many respects, very, very corrupt during the Middle Ages. Now, again, that isn't to say that that was true of every individual. That isn't to say that that was true of every teaching that that came out during that time period. That isn't to say that that was true of every movement during that time period. But the corruption and the abuses were widespread and legendary, to the point that by the time you got to the end of the High Middle Ages and into the Renaissance period, the people had completely lost their respect for the church because they saw how widespread these abuses were. For example, sexual immorality was unbelievably widespread. The idea was that the priests, the monks, the bishops, archbishops, the pope were all supposed to be celibate. That was the formal teaching of the church, and that was the practice within the church. They were supposed to be celibate. But everyone knew that the local priest had a concubine. Everyone knew that that there were bishops who were fathering children. Everyone knew. Now, again, this wasn't every priest, every bishop, every monk, but everyone knew that sexual immorality was rampant within the church during this time. The political maneuvering was unbelievable. As the church was the wealthiest and most powerful institution in the West, the political maneuvering and the intrigue were unbelievable during this time. The greed, I think I mentioned a little bit ago, that the church owned basically one-third of all of the land in Europe. So you could see how greed would become a factor in being a part of the church. Greed was rampant during this time. The practice of simony brought tremendous disrespect to the church during this time. The practice of simony, the tradition is that it goes back to the account in Acts, where Simon Magus comes to the apostles in the account in Acts and basically asks to have the apostles sell him the power of the Holy Spirit. That's very loosely the account of what happened in Acts. And so simony in the Middle Ages became the practice of buying and selling church offices. And you can see why that would be profitable business. Think of it today. If there was somebody who was the head of a major corporation and was making millions of dollars a year as the head of that corporation, if he could sell his position as the head of that corporation, he could make a lot of money in the sale of that position. Well, the leaders of the church, those who were in authority, the abbots of the monasteries, the bishops, the archbishops, those who were in authority controlled huge amounts of wealth, were themselves unbelievably wealthy beyond imagination, and so the practice of buying and selling church offices was rampant. If you want to be an archbishop, you just got to pony up enough money. Now, again, not in every case, but in many cases, it was a matter of who was willing to pay the most. And again, we'll see that come into play when we talk about the Reformation this next week. So you see all of these problems, and I would suggest, just by way of closing, I would suggest that probably the biggest problem, and the one that probably played the biggest role in the problems within the church, is that throughout the history of the church in the Middle Ages, the scriptures were not available to people. So it didn't matter if you were a bishop, an archbishop, a priest, a monk, an abbot of a monastery. Generally, the scriptures were unavailable to you for a couple of reasons. One was the simple fact that it wasn't the printing of books, the hand lettering of books, the creation of books, was such a time-consuming and expensive process that just having those books available they just simply were not widely available. You didn't have Bibles everywhere. Another problem had to do with the fact that going back to very, very early, well, prior to the Middle Ages, the New Testament and the Old Testament were translated into Latin That edition of the Bible is known as the Vulgate, and the Vulgate is what had become the standard Bible for the church in the Middle Ages. And so if you did not know Latin, now most of the archbishops, bishops probably had some Latin, but if you did not know Latin, you would not be able to read it. So the books weren't available. The Bible was in a language that most people, certainly the common people, certainly the nobles and lords, most of them really, the nobles and lords more so, but most of the people in Europe did not know Latin, and so they did not have the Bible in a language that they could understand. And then the problem was compounded further by a tradition very similar to the Jewish tradition, a tradition whereby the scriptures became less and less authoritative, and the commentaries on the scriptures, or the commentaries on the commentaries, were the things that became more and more authoritative. So what you ended up having taught in the universities were not the teachings of the Bible itself, but rather what was taught in the universities at that time would be the teachings of the church fathers, or the teachings when you get to the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, the teachings of the Greek and Roman philosophers. So you have what is taught in the universities is everything but the Bible. So there is a scarcity of understanding of what the scriptures have to say. Not available in a language people didn't understand, and the Bible was not itself taught in any way in a standalone way. So I think, in my mind, those are things that played a major role in contributing to the decline of the church in the Middle Ages. So that's it for today. I'll entertain some questions if you have some. And then this next week we're going to pick up on the Reformation. So if there are a couple of questions.
Peter, your command of church history information is quite impressive. I have two questions. Early on in this morning's presentation, did you imply that there was Christ's words were misinterpreted? Upon this rock, my church will be built. Is that more of a theological point? Upon this theological principle, my church will be built? And my second question is more of the latter part of your presentation. This political control by the church, is that why today we see in Iran, for example, that the spiritual leader confirms the supposed elected political leader? Is that principle still carried forward in the Eastern area?
Yeah. To answer your first question, yes, I think that was a misinterpretation of the passage in Matthew, and that becomes a huge issue in the Reformation, becomes a point of argument in the Reformation, because the question was, when Jesus made that comment, was he saying to Peter, and I say to you that I will build my church on you, Peter, the individual, and to you, Peter, I will give the keys of the kingdom, or was he making a more general observation, a more general comment about building the church upon the principle that Peter had enunciated? That was the discussion in the Reformation. Was it the principle that Peter had enunciated, that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God? Was that the principle upon which the church would be built, and that the keys of the kingdom, so to speak, would be given to the church in general, the power to loose and the power to bind? That became a major point of contention in the Reformation. And yes, I would suggest to you that the church's interpretation, narrow interpretation, that was the time at which Jesus gave ultimate authority to lead the church to Peter, the bishop who was to become the bishop of Rome. I would suggest that whole teaching, that whole line of reasoning is suspect. That they missed the boat. Then to answer your other question, yeah, hard to say. I think that there will always be a battle between church and state. There's a battle in our country today between church and state, even if it's not flaring out into the open right now. That's always going to be a struggle. Who is it that has ultimate authority over the actions, the behavior, the shaping of society, the values of society, that's always going to be a struggle. And certainly in Iran, in countries like that, that's a country where it's the spiritual leaders who have the ultimate authority. That's the place that they have in that society. They're the ones that have the ultimate authority in political things. And that's not the only place in this country or in the world today that's true. So I think that's an ongoing battle.
Peter, question, stylite, what does that mean? Did I pronounce that correctly?
Simon Stylites.
Yeah, the term stylite.
Yeah, it's just stylus, and I don't remember the exact Latin word, but it's just going to refer basically to the pillar, the stand upon which he built his platform. So he took his name after the pillar he lived on top of. Actually, I don't know if he took his name. That's traditionally the name that was given to him.
You talked early about the separation between the Eastern Church and the Western Church. Today, the Eastern Church calls to many in the Protestant movement and says, you know, you've split into 26,000 denominations, and obviously the Protestant movement has failed, and you really need to return to the historic church that hasn't changed since Christ gave it. Mm-hmm. So come to us. Could you give us some overview, even a quicker thumbnail sketch of what was happening in the East while all these things were happening in the West?
I couldn't, unfortunately.
Okay.
I'm not that familiar with the traditions, the Eastern Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, with those traditions. I have the impression that there was not quite the same fragmenting when we in the Protestant movement, or we who are heirs to the Protestant movement, when we're charged with splitting up into all sorts of different churches. It's true. But then there is a fundamental question of exactly what role does tradition play in the whole thing? Has God determined that tradition is intended to be authoritative? Did he intend, and this gets back to the question that was raised about the role of Peter, did God intend that the church or the tradition that was to be authoritative was authoritative simply because they could trace their historical lineage back the furthest? I mean, those are the questions that need to be raised, and I would suggest that isn't what God intended in the New Testament. But with regard to exactly what was going on in the church in the East, I don't have the impression that there was as much fragmentation. I'm not aware of a Reformation in the East as there was in the West in the 16th century, but I'm not, that's not my area of specialty, quite honestly. So
back to the Scholastic movement, how exactly did the professor's statements morph into church dogma?
Well, basically, the Scholastic movement, the leaders of the church were not themselves necessarily academics. There were academic centers at universities in Western Europe at the time who filled that void, who had to give shape to the teaching and the understanding. And so those centers of learning were, in fact, supported by the church. They were, in fact, basically, in some sense, church institutions. So the academics provided the theoretical ammunition, if you will, for shaping and forming the doctrine of the church. And it's always an interesting thing to look at in the history of the church, because even amongst the academics, every once in a while somebody would step far enough out of line that they ran afoul of the church also. But to try to answer your question, basically the church itself, its academic or doctrinal arm, if you will, was in the universities. And it was the universities and the academics that continued to develop theology. And as it was circulated amongst the universities, gained general assent, many of those things eventually would be given the seal of approval, if you will, by the Pope, that would actually codify some of those dogmas, some of those teachings.
So I can understand where an academic may take an existing church doctrine and create a rationale for it and get the stamp. But were they actually taking unanswered questions, creating a rationale for their answer, and then the guy said, okay, add that to the church?
Absolutely.
Just make the list a little longer each time those papers are published.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were developments of teaching within the church that that grew and changed over the years as some teaching would be expanded on, other new issues would be raised and would be discussed and eventually would become part of the dogma of the church. So yeah, it was not simply discussing again the same issues. It was fine-tuning and expanding and even growing the issues that were being discussed. Jack, did you want to say something about that?
Absolutely, but you have to understand that their whole mindset of an academic in the Middle Ages would have been different than today, because instead of being innovative, there was no virtue in being innovative. You needed to be preservative. There are three authorities that everyone accepted as the authority. The Bible was an authority, church tradition and ecclesiastical decisions was an authority, and Plato and or Aristotle was an authority. And the whole scholastic movement was an attempt to reconcile what all of those authorities said so that you could, and that's why you get the subtlety of thought that you do in scholasticism, is because they actually had to figure out a way to take flat-out contradictions and make them not contradictory. So they reconciled all those authorities. The only time they would get in trouble, they could be innovative in answering questions that hadn't been answered before. But the only way they would get in trouble is if they actually offered something that was not consistent with one of those three authorities. Then they'd get in trouble and the church would stomp down on them.
Although what I would suggest is that, yes, those three authorities, but I would suggest that in many respects the Bible was the lowest of those authorities.
Yes,
absolutely. Because the understanding was simply that the church teaching, it was just a given for them that the church teaching as it had developed over the years and evolved embodied the teaching of the Bible. So little attention was paid to real study of the Bible.
No, just that's true. There are really only two effective authorities.
Right.
The Bible is only nominally authority.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Anybody else? We'll wrap up here with this.
Peter, maybe I missed it, but you said that Pope Boniface did two things. And the first was instilling the sacraments as a means of salvation. I missed the second thing.
Well, the first was actually Boniface laid out the dogma that there was salvation only within the church. Mm-hmm. That if you were not within the church, and part of the definition of being within the church had to do with participating in the sacraments. So if you were not within the church, there was no salvation for you. And then more clearly laying out what the sacramental system was all about.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We'll pick up the Reformation next week.